Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Core Intuition, well and truly worn down.
Well, Manton, it's been almost 2 weeks since we left San Francisco under the dizzying spell of Tim Cook and his crew's announcements from Apple. And today, as we record this, Wednesday, June 18th, 2014, Amazon has stepped up to the podium to try to dizzyingly amaze us with, wait for it, the Amazon Fire Phone.
Yeah, and it's, I guess, since Apple didn't announce any hardware at all at the event, this is kind of the first exciting new phone, like, for the year or for the fall. And so I was fascinated with this, and I usually don't follow live coverage for anything that's not Apple, because I did a couple times and then just felt like I just wasted hours following this stuff that just doesn't matter, because I'm not going to buy the phone. I'm not going to buy the not iPhone. But I did follow this one because I was just really curious about it, because there was so much hype leading up to it about where, you know, they're trying something different, this 3D face tracking stuff. And I don't know, for some reason I was really curious about it. And it turns out there's not a whole bunch of surprises, but they're doing a bunch of Amazon-like things, you know, scan something and buy it right away. Bunch of cloud storage stuff for photos, which makes a lot of sense. And then, as predicted, you know, it's got way too many cameras on it, so it can track you, which is cool technology, I guess. Also, maybe a little creepy, but pretty cool.
Yeah, well, you know, looking at this phone, one thing I can say is, you know, I'm really glad that Apple sort of set the standard for what other phones should look like, because I think this is a pretty attractive looking phone. It's attractive because it's relatively simple in its design. And we're out of that era when, you know, everything was like phones with like wings on them and stuff. You know, it was like there was that era where it was like the phone practically had to have like streamliner camper van, you know, like ridges going down the sides of them to be stylish in somebody's view. And these days, it's really hard, actually, to tell at a glance whether somebody is using an iPhone or some Android phone. And this, maybe even more than ever, looks like, you know, it kind of looks like an Apple design just looking at it. They, you're right, they did litter the front of it with cameras, and I guess that was to meet a design goal. But at least they, assuming that each of those camera-looking holes at the four corners of the front of the phone is in fact a camera, well, at least they sort of arranged them in a way that kind of looks almost like screw holes or something, right? And it looks industrial almost in the way that they're symmetrical and at the corners.
Yeah, definitely symmetrical. It looks fine to me. It looks good, actually. It looks very good. I don't think it would be distracting having the little cameras there.
No.
Cool technology, I guess. I'd love to play with one of these. I don't know if they will actually have any in like an AT&T store. It's exclusively on AT&T. And that, again, is kind of an advantage that Apple has over everybody else, the fact that you can just go into your Apple store. Not everybody has one, but
right.
There's a bunch across the world now.
I would probably guess that anywhere near anything that you would describe as urban, at least in the Western world, right? Mm-hmm. Quote unquote Western world, there's going to be an Apple store there. Like even like little states in the U.S. that we don't usually think of as having notable cities, if they've got kind of like a big-ish city, it's going to have an Apple store.
Yeah, and if not, they're going to have a couple mobile phone company stores that you can check the stuff out.
Right.
So I don't know with Amazon. They don't have their own stores. Maybe they'll have some of these in stores, or maybe it'll just be exclusively online. I didn't notice if they said that.
Yeah.
So obviously Amazon's history is online orders. And I like that they usually play to that strength. So for example, the cloud stuff I hinted at, I think is great.
You know,
put all your photos in the cloud. Google's going to do that. Apple's sort of almost doing that. And the Mayday feature too, with tech support, right?
Right.
You wait a few seconds and you can live chat with your helper. They can do all that stuff because that's their strength to kind of compensate for the fact that you can't just walk into a retail store.
Yeah. You know, I haven't even looked too carefully at all the details of this phone. But one thing that strikes me is, of all of Apple's competitors, Amazon strikes me as the one that can sort of put together a package and deliver it in a compelling way. It's like, maybe these aren't the most important features to me, you know, shopping assistants and 3D, you know, renderings and whatever. But they're sort of in contrast to some phone makers who seem to just be sort of chasing Apple's style, right? And like I just said, obviously, I think the case of this is, you know, very much in line with that Apple style. But they're smart enough to say, hey, like you just said, Manton, what are our sort of like unique offerings, and what can we put together as like a 3-bullet point pitch for this phone to people who, let's face it, are by default going to be choosing between Samsung or Apple. And it looks like it's a pretty interesting offer. And then they're able also to leverage some of their platformness by, for example, if you buy the phone, you get a free year of Amazon Prime.
Yeah, and that's makes the phone basically $100, right?
That's right. Well, you know, it knocks $100 off the price, which is, as you suggested, $200 with a contract and $649 without one. So that's about the same. That's the same ballpark as most of Apple's new iPhones when they come out, right?
Yeah, and they also said in the presentation that they have tens of millions of Prime customers, which that's a nice little revenue stream. Of course, the free shipping has to be included in that, but I thought that was an interesting number to throw out. Apple, of course, brags about 800 million iTunes accounts.
Just a few.
Which is more than tens of millions. But tens of millions is still good. Mm-hmm. And I can see Amazon, you know, we're used to buying a bunch of stuff from them. I'm sure that I give Amazon more money than I give Apple, although it's kind of weird to say that.
Interesting.
But I'm sure it's got to be true. I mean, it's just between books and random stuff for the house. I mean, we ordered, you know, a Nest last week.
Yep.
That's a couple $100 right there, whatever. So, I mean, I'm sure I give Amazon more money over time than I give Apple. But because it's just basic stuff, usually I don't really think about the fact that, yes, they have my credit card, actually probably several of our credit cards on file. And they could do stuff with that.
Yes, you know, absolutely.
Whether it's an app store or whether it's, you know, all the Prime-related stuff that they're working on.
You know, you make an interesting point. I give an awful lot of money to Amazon as well, and I don't think about it very often because, you know, I'm just it's the markup cost or whatever that I'm giving them, whatever they mark up over the price of the thing they're selling me in general. But also on the trust front, you know, what's so powerful about Apple is I basically trust them with my credit card to safeguard at least my you know, name and address. To be honest with you, I actually have, you know, Amazon has earned a similar trust with me. And if I am, you know, on the verge of buying something, let's say I want to back something on Kickstarter, it's no skin off my back to like let Amazon take that, you know, the financial end of that. For whatever it's worth, I am far more likely to let Amazon sort of deal with my credit card information than I am to let many, many other companies out there deal with it. I guess there's something to be said for that. If I had to say who's the runner up to Apple for my sort of brand loyalty, I guess, it's funny because I never think about them in terms of like, would I buy a Kindle Fire or a Fire phone? But as far as like signing up for the infrastructure of a company, you know, for the network that they're offering me, yeah, I'm pretty much like all in with them. And there's not any other company that comes to mind that I can say that for. And the companies that I'm sort of quote unquote in with, apart from Apple and Amazon, are just like necessities, like Verizon for internet, right? But it's not like I feel overwhelmingly confident that Verizon's, you know, got my back. But I do sort of feel like Amazon is, you know, relatively respectful of me, you know?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. There was a time a few years ago where for a moment I was mad and frustrated with Apple, and I sent them with Amazon, and I sent them an angry email about, because one of those stories came out about the environment in some of their warehouses and how terrible it is. And I was like, oh my God, they got to be better at this, right? Because they are good at customer support. They are good at user experience. They've got to treat their employees better. But like I've said, in the context of other companies, rage on the internet doesn't last forever. And hopefully they've done a better job at that recently. But I don't know. I haven't followed up on it. But for the most part, over the last decade or however long, 20 years, how long has Amazon been around?
I think it's been about 20 years. I think you're right. Because I remember starting to see the Amazon boxes pop up in Apple in the mailroom. And I think that must have been around 97 or so.
Yeah. So almost that long. Long time. And I've been ordering stuff and I've been happy with them as a company.
Remember way back? I think it was way back then. When it was like, oh, this upcomer Amazon is really giving CD Now a run for the money.
Right.
Remember CD Now? And I think I first ordered CDs from CD Now. Am I remembering that name right? You seem to recognize. Yeah, that's it.
Yes.
I just Googled it. CDnow.com was an online retailer founded in February 1994. And the funny thing is, I think it may have been another company around that same time, but I think I may have ordered my first merchandise off the internet from CD Now through a Telnet prompt. I think that they had,
what?
I think that they offered Telnet based, put down the drugs, Daniel.
Gopher Gateway.
Yeah, I think it was something
CDs.
Like that. I think it was like before the web had really taken off, they were already trying to offer online sales. It may have been somebody else, but it was back in that early days. And I remember consciously thinking, how can I trust this Telnet session with my credit card number? But I went for it and I got CDs through the mail.
This is like pre-SSL.
It was. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was like...
That's hilarious.
It was a crazy time.
The other thing with Amazon that's sticks out to me is they have an SDK for some of their new hardware features, the scanning Firefly thing and the 3D stuff. And that is another thing that seems a lot like Apple and is a place they can show that they're doing something different and potentially have exclusive apps. Up until now, I assume everything on Amazon's tablets has been kind of a quick Android port, you know, kind of just rebuild it, re-upload it, whatever, very minimal work. But now, for the first time, they could have kind of exclusive apps, which is something Apple has. They love to talk about their exclusive iOS games and apps that maybe, even if they eventually, you know, get over to Android, a lot of apps start on iOS. And I don't know if we'll see that with the Fire Phone, but the fact that Amazon's kind of pushing that makes a lot of sense to me.
Amazon is... How many years have we been saying that Amazon is like... Every year they come out with something new. We think, who would have thought that Amazon would have done that? Who would have thought that Amazon would sell not just books online? I think that was the big deal. They were like, books and now CDs. And CD Now, suck it, right? And then they're like, oh, now I remember Amazon selling garbage bags now. Well, that's weird. And then, of course, today they sell almost anything you can imagine. And then they started moving into web services, S3, stuff like that. And they made the Amazon Fire tablet and now the phone. And it's interesting to me that like a lot of the big tech companies these days, like if you consider like Apple, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, they are like building up these similar product lines, right? Like they've got some hardware devices, often like a phone, often a tablet. And then they've got like these media sales enterprises. You know, Amazon has their streaming stuff. Apple has streaming. Google has, I think they still have streaming. And then it's just so fascinating to me that all of these companies are sort of like zeroing in on like maybe three or four roughly approximate businesses and just duking it out. Right. And, you know, like online music, you know, streaming music, whatever, they've all got something.
Yeah, what is it that these companies feel like they have to do everything? Is it impossible for a company to be successful and not do hardware and cloud and music? And I mean, it seems like it should be possible. And when you think about Apple, they seem fairly focused, but they're doing all these things.
Yeah.
They're not selling garbage bags, but I mean...
Right, that's the thing. Sorry to interrupt, Manton, but the beauty of Apple is they're not being bogged down by the thing that doesn't actually make that much money, I would assume. I don't know. You know, you always hear that Amazon is just breaking even over the years, and it seems to me that if there was anything that could really help them stop just breaking even, it would be to have high-margin hardware sales.
Well, you also always hear, though, that at any time, they could just turn a little knob and they'd make an extra few million dollars that 5 seconds, right?
Yep.
They could raise the price of their garbage bags 5 cents and then tune it back down. I mean, they can play with that, and it's almost like Jeff Bezos is playing this long 15-plus year game where he's building all this up, and then at some point he's just going to like flip a switch, and suddenly they're going to be even bigger than we imagined.
It's like he's got this tap, this water tap of money that he's just like being judicious about, only like letting a trickle come out. And then it's just going to be, whoops. So maybe all that trust I talked about having in Amazon is ill-placed. And actually, now that you mention it, Manton, one of the things that really bugs me about Amazon is their variable pricing, because it's one of those things where I don't even know if I'm being duped or not when I shop at Amazon. You know about this? How, like, if you go to Amazon and I go to Amazon, look at the same product, we'll probably see a different price.
Yeah, I've seen kind of mention of that here and there. And I do know that prices change more than I'd like them to. Like I mentioned, we ordered that Nest. We have an upstairs and downstairs AC, and I wasn't sure we wanted to go completely all in on the Nest, so we just ordered one for downstairs because our thermostat was flaky anyway and had some issues. And I went to order a second one because it arrived, we put it together, and I love this thing. It's great.
Yeah.
So order a second one. Turns out the price was like $40 more. This is only a few days later. So maybe that's part of what you're saying.
Yep.
I don't know. But certainly I am a big fan of prices that, you know, pick a price and stick there. And of course, with the App Store, we're used to prices going all over the map. But I like the idea that something is worth a certain amount and the price is fairly stable.
Right. And then as a software seller, of course, I like the idea that the price is totally variable, always at the peak of whatever the shopper is willing to pay. You know, there's the Amazon way of looking at this, which is, you know, they do want to get... The fact of the matter is, Manton, you and I still buy tons of stuff from Amazon, even with their variable prices, even knowing that, like, I'm paying a few bucks more than my neighbor sometimes. I'm still going there because it's just, I guess all the other benefits happen to outweigh that.
Well, the convenience is unbeatable. And also the prices are also usually unbeatable. Even if you pay 5 cents more than your neighbor, it's probably 5 cents less than driving to the store.
So do you happen to remember how much you paid for your Nest, the first one and the second one?
I believe I paid $225 for the first one.
And then for the second one?
So actually I decided because of the... It was at least $20 more. I decided not to order it on Amazon.
Okay, yeah.
And I mean, I was going to, and then I noticed Lowe's down the street had it on sale or something. Anyway,
okay,
paid the same price.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now, and it says, and you have to be careful when you look at Amazon and compare prices. You have to make sure you're looking at prices that say ships from and sold by Amazon.com.
Right.
Because sometimes people have said, oh, they shift their prices all over the place, and then you ask them for an example, and they say, like this one, and it'll say like ships and sold by, you know, fell off the truck industries.
Right. Well, and that's one of the strengths though, is right. If they're sold out, they might kind of seamlessly show you someone else that's selling.
Yes, it is a strength, but it's also very confusing. I find myself having to be very diligent about trying to make sure I'm actually buying from Amazon, especially with things that can be counterfeit. And even then, apparently it's not a guarantee. But, you know, I used to, for a long time, I used to just assume that Prime meant from Amazon. And even that is not the case, because they offer Prime shipping on behalf of, you know, vendors who allow Amazon to sell their stuff.
Right.
But right now I'm looking at Amazon and it says in stock and will sell by Amazon.com Nest Learning Thermostat, second generation, $249.
Yeah, I see exactly the same thing.
Okay.
And I believe it was, I want to say it was $229 when I first ordered it. And I don't know, I not sure what the difference there was. Because I think $249 is the correct retail price. And I just got lucky.
Maybe they had felt like you weren't buying enough stuff and they wanted to get you back in the mood.
Well, that's the thing. Who knows? Because I've browsed thinking about buying this thermostat many, many times over the last year. Maybe they've got some magic algorithm that said, like, today, if he checks and we give him $20 off,
he's going to go
for it. We've made a sale.
Yeah. Oh my God, I wouldn't be surprised if it's that creepy and far more creepy. But here I am looking at it, Amazon. I need you to lower this price for me if we're going to make any traction. $249, I don't know. Maybe I'll come back and look tomorrow.
Yeah, it's such an interesting company, and I want to see one of these phones in person. Again, I have no plans to buy one because I'm totally happy with my nice iPhone 5C. And I've got to say, more people were fascinated with my 5C at WWDC than anything else.
You're the one. Kit, you're the one who bought one. You're the guy who bought a 5C.
I saw one other one in the wild during the week.
Wow.
But people. I don't know. People universally, people look at it and they're like, "I love the way that looks and feels, and I love everything about the 5C now that I've seen it." But yeah, I bought the 5S.
Yeah,
that's the default.
Well, you know, Manson, one last thing about Amazon is, their main purpose in life, at least it appears to be, is to keep selling like physical and virtual merchandise, right? Like they like to sell trash bags and books and CDs and movies online and TV shows. So the good news for those of us who aren't willing to invest in a Kindle Fire, whatever it is, the Fire phone, is actually Amazon is pretty motivated to make like a cool app for iOS. So like I have the Amazon app on iOS and it doesn't do everything that this phone does, but some of the cool stuff, like, have you played with it? The Amazon app on iOS, you can point it at a product and it'll try to figure out what the product is, like not necessarily just the barcode. Right. And you just, and it's got all these little, it's kind of cool. It's very geeky the way it looks. It shows all these little points of light where it's like trying to feel out the edges of whatever you're looking at.
So I guess that's fairly similar to the feature that's baked into their new phone.
Yeah, I would guess so. And I, you know, I like, I often forget it's in there, but when I heard this announcement about the Fire phone, I opened up my iPhone app and played around with it a little bit. It's pretty cool. Like it doesn't get a lot of things that are just objects, but if you point it at like a book cover, you don't even have to point it at the barcode. Usually it'll just like figure it out and say, oh yeah, I got that in stock.
That's cool.
So that, you got to hand it to Amazon. I mean, I'm not like, I don't think that like the end all be all of technology should be consumerism based, you know, utilities. But the fact is I do like to shop for things. I like to get the right price and I like to know, you know, comparison shop. And it's pretty powerful to be able to point at something and say, just let me know like the gist of what's up with this product.
Yeah, it's cool. Beats typing something in. Okay, this week we are happy to have Crashlytics back sponsoring the podcast. Crashlytics, you've probably heard us say by now, but if you're new to the show or don't listen carefully in previous weeks, it's a crash reporting framework for iOS and Android and Mac. They also do beta distribution now, something new they've added. But the core of it is the crash reporting. I use this in my app Tweet Library. I've been using it for at least a year or so, and I'm really happy with how well it works. It's very easy to integrate. You add the SDK, it walks you through the process, and then before you know it, when your app crashes on your customers' phones, iPod touches, iPads, whatever, the crashes get sent up to Crashlytics server, and you can easily filter them, look at different versions, look at bugs you fixed, haven't fixed, and basically just discover where the problems in your app are that you didn't even know about. So it's really nice. I actually had several new bugs in my app a few weeks ago. They showed up on Crashlytics right away, of course. And I also heard from customers that, you know, there's a problem. It never crashed on my device. It's one of those things that for one reason or another I couldn't reproduce it easily, but I could see the crash logs and I could see that they were kind of going up for one version. And so I could kind of drill down and figure out what was actually happening. So it's a great service and you can check it out at crashlytics.com.
Yeah, you know, Manson, we spent the first half of this show, oddly enough, talking about an Android device. And we usually talk about Crashlytics and how it's such a great iOS crash reporter and now a Mac crash reporter. But the fact is they also do, have Android support as well. And I think that they're kind of a big deal on Android. It's just we don't usually talk about Android. But as it happens, you know, they are having a party at Google I.O. So I know lots of our listeners probably slightly favor or vastly favor iOS, but a lot of them are also developing for both platforms. And it's worth mentioning, you know, not only that you can use Crashlytics on Android, but Crashlytics is going to be at Google I.O. and having this big party. They kind of have a reputation for their parties at WWDC, and they're having a party at Google I.O., which is the party is on June 24th. So go to crashlytics.com/blog, and you can read more about that. And, of course, learn more about the service if for some reason you haven't tried it yet. Thanks again. It's always great to have your support. Thanks, Crashlytics, for sponsoring the show.
All right, I wanted to follow up on something we talked about before WWDC. This was Panic made a post saying they're going to pull Coda from the App Store for the next version because the sandboxing problems, the requirements, they just couldn't make it work, even though they worked really closely with Apple. They couldn't pull it off. And I made the statement that if something good for sandboxing to make developers' lives easier was coming at WWDC, they would never have posted this. So we had a little bit of a discussion on the Glassboard, and Jared Sorge commented that, you know, you don't know for sure what's going to happen at WWDC. And after the conference, he followed up saying, you know, did you guys hear anything? Like,
yeah,
is sandboxing even a topic? And I'd completely forgotten about this. So thanks, Jared, for mentioning it, because we were so excited about everything that Apple did at the conference. And just universally, everyone thought that it was a great show. I completely forgot about some of the negative stuff and my pessimistic prediction about sandboxing. So short answer to this is I haven't seen anything about sandboxing, any improvements, but I haven't watched all the sessions. So have you heard anything?
I have not heard anything per se about improvements to sandboxing, but here's my short take on it. WWDC, all the new stuff they announced with, you know, notification center plugins and extensions, all these goodies that are all based on XPC, right? And they're all very security minded. Those are the cementing of Apple's sandboxed based strategy going forward. Mm-hmm. I don't expect any, like, some people have been holding on to this, like, in this vain hope that somehow Apple's going to, like, abandon sandboxing and say, oh, well, that was a bad idea, obviously. And right. I think it's been pretty clear for a while that's not going to happen. But if you needed more evidence, all of the stuff, all the most exciting stuff, really, that they announced as new developer opportunities on the Mac are sort of based in this idea of expanding upon sandboxing. I was hoping that we might get some more, like, real specific, like, I don't know, you know, specific, like, new entitlements that might help Panic or other folks who are trying to do great software and don't want to, you know, endanger users. They just want to do the best job they can, and the current sandbox doesn't let them do that. But I do think it's fair to say that, you know, some of this stuff, like extensions, I don't know, I was talking about this the other day. I still can't get my head around all the things that it's like Apple's given us so many new sort of directions we could look in for new opportunities, new products, new enhancements to our existing apps. I really don't know how to get my head around it, but I think that extensions, for one, are an area where it should provide a lot of people who are stymied by sandboxing.
Yeah,
I don't know, maybe a way around that in the long term. Like you can imagine, I mean, not every problem obviously, but you can imagine that some of the things that people need to use superpowers for, so to speak, in their apps could be replaced in the long term by, you know, new entitlements from Apple. Obviously that's one way, but also by you know, the ability to leverage other apps functionality directly in the app. So, like before, some people are like having trouble with sandboxing because they can't control, say, another app as well as they used to be able to. Well, what if you don't need to control the other app anymore because you can just politely ask the app to exist within your UI?
Yeah, it's weird because the new stuff is fantastic. And I do think that extensions, especially on iOS, it's the biggest opportunity the developers have had in years to build brand new types of apps that were impossible before. And I think it's a huge opportunity. I would love on day one to have something that used that technology. But it doesn't really directly address the problems for legacy apps. Like, I don't think, like, Coda, for example, I don't think anything's changed for them.
Nope.
My app, Clipstart, it assumes in the current version that it can read and write everywhere on the hard drive, and nothing's changed for that. So it's a huge advantage for, it's kind of solving new problems, but it's kind of sweeping the old problems under the rug. And, you know, maybe that's not necessarily bad. I mean, I don't want to say that the new stuff isn't great, because it is.
Yeah.
But nothing's really changed for the old stuff. And I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just a lot of people say, you know, just look at what Apple wants you to build and build that and stop trying to fight it, because it's mm-hmm. a losing battle. And I think there's some sense in that. At the same time, there's types of apps that you just want to build that don't work in the App Store on the Mac. And I still think that's valuable.
Yeah. It's foolish to assume that Apple has any particular sentimentality about quote unquote legacy apps, you know,
right.
And obviously they love, obviously they love Panic, and they love a lot of what Panic has done. And they probably even love Coda and even love its features, which can't be squeezed into the sandbox. But, you know, think back, Manton, to the old Mac OS 8, Mac OS 9 days, and some of the apps that sort of like had the public's imagination as like, they were like big, like popular, hugely popular, like wide-reaching apps like Window Shade, utilities like that, right? Remember when, mm-hmm. and then Apple incorporated that, but you know, Window Shade, Kaleidoscope, which let you like change the themes of your UI, right?
Yeah.
And then Mac OS X came along, more or less, this whole class of cool, nifty utilities like that was essentially impossible. And it was because of increased security. I mean, really, in case of Mac OS X, it was like, kind of, you know, logical security that came in the form of like, you know, address spaces, separate address spaces for apps and stuff like that. But suffice to say, we gave up on a whole class of apps when we moved to Mac OS X. Yeah. And you could have said at that time, well, this is impossible. Apple has to turn this around. Apple has to provide something to allow third-party developers who have been so successful. Like those were some, like Kaleidoscope, I think, was a pretty successful app, right?
I think so, probably.
There's always going to be some apps that don't make the cut, you know, and like going to sandboxing, I sure am glad that FastScripts isn't my moneymaker, right? Because if it was my moneymaker, Apple would be essentially putting me out of business with the move to sandboxing, because I can't do what I want to do with mm-hmm. sandboxing. But I really do think when it comes down to it, I really empathize with the Panic guys and Coda. But at the end of the day, I guess some of those features just have to come out of the app, and maybe you have to think about things creatively. Maybe there needs to be a dedicated. Like, I know one of their problems, right, is that they want to have like a terminal, because they have a built-in terminal, right?
Yeah.
And so they want to be able to run that from within Coda as they always have. Well, that's not possible. I haven't looked at the extension stuff very carefully yet, but I don't know. Is it possible to have a third-party app that's not in the Mac App Store, but which supplies extension behavior to an app that is in the Mac App Store? And therefore, could Panic make a terminal sort of service, an extension that provides a terminal window to whichever app desires one?
But at that point, you're really watering down your Mac App Store app. And, you know, I mean, the whole point of Coda is that it does all this stuff in one window.
Yeah.
And so if you can't ship that in the Mac App Store, I have to assume this is the conclusion they came to. If you can't ship your app like you want it to be, that it does all this stuff with different tabs and it's integrated, then there's no point. Don't do it. You just ship it outside the Mac App Store. I still think that makes sense because, yeah, I mean, so you have this idea for an app, a productivity app. It does a bunch of things. And then you realize you can only ship it in the Mac App Store if it does half those things. Well, you were super excited about those four or five things it did. And if you can only ship two of those,
yeah.
At the beginning of this whole process, would you have even built the app if it could only ship those two, right? It's so crippled at that point,
yep.
This hypothetical app, that it's something you would never have built. And I think that's the thing that Panic faced with Coda is, we could take out the terminal tab.
Yeah.
We could take out the file browser and this other integration we want to do. But then we're no better than anything else, and we would never have bothered to build Coda to begin with if it was going to be like this.
I don't know. I think I'm getting well and truly worn down by the moving, you know, the unstoppable force of Apple's movement into the future. And I totally relate to that thinking. In fact, that's when I say, like, fast scripts, for instance, can't be sandboxed. What I really mean is it would hurt my feelings too much to take out the features that I like. And I think there's a lot to that. Like, it's hard to think real rationally about it. And like, for instance, you said half the features, but I think in the case of most app, it's more like a tenth of the features, but it's a tenth of the features that the developers, of course, are married to because they invented them. They thought it was worth, like you said, they thought it was worth the time to do it. And there are features often which differentiate from other apps out there.
Yeah.
I almost feel like, this sounds so weird to say, Manton, but I almost feel like we'd be better off if we didn't have the option to keep selling stuff directly.
What?
What? Say what?
Crazy.
Because there's this, it's a twisted sort of psychological challenge for us now, because I think it's, I mean, I don't know. I already regret saying that. Okay, Manton? Yeah.
But I hear what you're saying. It would make our life easier in terms of choices.
Yeah.
But we would not be better off. We are always better off if there is a way to build an app and distribute it out outside the App Store. I still wish we had that on iOS.
Right.
Even if it's only 1% of developers who take advantage of that, and even if users don't trust it, we'll always be better off if we can build things and ship them without anyone's approval. But I hear what you're saying. It would make life easier in some ways.
Well, here's the thing. I think there's so much psychological stuff going on because developers love their apps and they love every single last nuanced feature of their apps. But the fact of the matter is customers don't have that same view, and Apple doesn't have that same view. Somebody like Panic with Coda and somebody like Daniel Jalkut with Fast Scripts, if they could divorce themselves a little bit from their like emotional attachment to the app as it was, and rethink it as an app that has to exist in this constrained system. You know, maybe it won't, it's never going to be the same app, but we are thinking individuals who know how to like add features to things. And I think it's fair to say that Coda, there's an app out there that lives in a sandbox that is extremely useful and is comparable to Coda in the future. And yes, it would lose some features if they were forced to adopt the sandbox now. But, you know, I mean, some apps clearly it's like, okay, you can't do the one thing that you're supposed to do. So you definitely can't live in the sandbox. But I think that's a useful exercise for people to think, what would I do if I was building this up from scratch and I had to live within the confines of the sandbox? And the truth is often, I think, it's not as terrible of an outcome for the app as it is sort of just humiliating and sort of like dispiriting to have to give up on hard-won features just because of a policy change by Apple.
Right. One of the great things about WWDC this year is that there's so much to be excited about that it's like new stuff you can build. And a couple people commented after the show that like, it wasn't like we were forced to make changes and build things. It's all new stuff that we actually wanted to. And
right.
I really like that. And it's hard for me sometimes to see sandboxing in that light, as all I see is the negative and I don't see it's an opportunity to simplify my UI and rethink my app and ship something. But there is some of that. It is an opportunity to make changes, in drastic changes that might be for the better.
Yeah. I mean, I've been saying this since day one with sandboxing. It's been that the technology itself has a lot of pluses. And I, for one, this is a debate we have sometimes with us developers, right? I, for one, am grateful for the fact that in my sandboxed versions of my apps, for instance, I shipped sandboxed version of Black Ink, the crossword app. It's really kind of comforting to me now that I can't, you know, when I'm throwing away a puzzle file, I can't accidentally like right. build the path wrong and then yeah. throw away half the user's computer.
I that is compelling. I agree. Because I have code in my apps that's like super, super paranoid.
Super paranoid, yeah.
Like, check is it a file? Is it a folder? Is it a folder that I expect yeah. to be in a certain place? Am I going to recursively delete anything? If so, bail out. I mean, it's helpful to be paranoid when you could yes. potentially cause some real damage. And sandboxing certainly eliminates some of that. You could still cause damage. Yeah. Like Clipstart, if I make it sandboxed, I still could potentially delete all the user's family
right,
videos,
right?
Which is still really, really bad.
It's about the worst thing you could do short of deleting yeah. their whole disk.
Yeah. But yeah, there's some comfort there yeah. for sure. I don't know. I can't do sandboxing. I'm too busy rewriting all my apps in Swift.
So. Yeah, right. Oh, well, Manton, I don't know. Apple sure keeps us busy, don't they?
Yeah, and I'm kidding about Swift. I've definitely, over the last couple of weeks, my policy on that is I'm not going to actually touch it for 6 months. It's super awesome. I love what they're doing, but I have a lot of work to do, and I need to focus all my time on code that I know how to write
yeah.
right now.
You know what, Manton, here's one last thought about that sandboxing stuff. Apple has been now shipping sandboxing for what, like 2 years, maybe 3 years?
I think three, probably.
Oh my God, making me feel terrible. But here's the thing, it gets better every year. Whatever the state of the sandboxing status quo is, and this year, like we said, we don't think anything particularly got better with the technology itself, but the sort of environment around sandboxing offers more now. I think that that's going to be the story. And one thing Apple is good at is they're good at breaking some bad news to developers that doesn't really get ameliorated until 5 years later, right? It's like when they brought out 10.0, right? It was good news on the one hand. It's an all-new operating system based on Unix. It's powerful, multitasking, protected memory, la, 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 la. Developers are like, say what? Have to recompile my apps? I have no users? Like, you don't even have any customers on 10.0 yet. What am I supposed to do? Oh, you're going to let them run Classic in a virtualization window? No thanks. I'll stick with Mac OS 9. Right? And then 10.1 comes along. Ah, are you kidding me? After all those bugs in 10.0, this is still crap.
Mm-hmm.
10.2, and then 10.4, 10.6. Yep. No, and it's distant memory to anybody that you would ever yearn for Mac OS 9. And Mac OS 9, the glorious Mac OS 9, where you can do whatever app you want, and all of the users are there. And, you know, it doesn't have all those Mac OS 10 bugs. And 5 years, well, 5 years from now for sure, but 5 years from when sandboxing came out, 2 years from now, I don't know, a lot of us might be looking at software in a whole different light.
Yeah, you're right. It really is nice to be able to step back and think 2 or 3 years. Apple does it, and as developers, we should try to do it as well. Think a little bit in the future, because the future looks a lot different than it does today. Even simple things like what version of the OS are you going to require? Yeah. Well, today, it's kind of a hard choice, but if you imagine your app existing in 2 years, it's a no-brainer that you don't support 10.6 anymore.
Right.
Yep. It's so obvious. So, yeah.
And the future comes quickly, too. I mean, just the fact that it's been 3 years since sandboxing came out, and the day sandboxing comes out, you think, oh no, I'm doomed. I got to rewrite all my apps and sandboxed. And the fact is, Manton, I've only shipped one app that's sandboxed in those 3 years. All right, I'm going to go have a beer now.
Get back to work. Yeah, well, that's good though. It's good that you didn't have to. That's definitely the
right
glasses half full argument. You didn't have to drop everything
right
away. Cool. Well, this has a bunch to work on. I'm very excited still. I have my gripes about things on the Apple platforms, but there's a lot of cool stuff happening in the next couple months. And mm-hmm. and even some of the sandbox, I mean, it's not directly related to sandboxing, but it's related to kind of silos and apps like the iCloud Drive.
Yep.
Kind of opening up iCloud and file storage, I think is going to be huge. And it's related a little bit to this.
Yeah.
You know, breaking down some of the barriers across apps.
Right. And like in 1 year from now, probably 80% of Apple's customers are going to be running 10.10, right?
I don't know about 80, but yeah, it's going to be a lot.
How
you're making stuff up, right? It's 50% now are on 10.9.
Is that all? I'm definitely making stuff up. Listen, 110% of people.
It's on iOS that like 80% or 75 or something are on 7. On the Mac, I think it's over half, but not like 3/4. But still, that's huge. That's faster adoption than we've seen in a long time.
All right, Manton. Well, I'm going to get back to work and see about this this newfangled sandboxing thing.
Great. Well, good talking to you. Thanks, everybody, for listening to the show. Also, shout out to the jobs board. We still trucking with that. If you need a job, check out jobs.corn.org. And definitely, if you're looking to hire any developers, we've gotten some really great feedback. We got some quotes up there, but I'll put some more up, some feedback we've gotten recently. People saying we've gotten so many good resumes from it that it was totally worth it. In fact, we had to hire extra people because we had so many good qualified folks come in. So check that out if you're looking to hire anybody.
That's right. The people who are putting listings on jobs.corent.org are actually stealing the potential employees that you would be hiring. How about that for fear, uncertainty, and doubt?
Cool. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.
See you, Manton.